The Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis is a much-loved work of literature, but it is not universally loved. One detractor is the writer Philip Pullman. He's an atheist who's written his own trilogy in response to Lewis's Christian allegory. Now, in a new book, Philip Pullman reimagines the story of Jesus. NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
Pullman was inspired to write a book about Jesus by an unlikely source, the Archbishop of Canterbury. It happened one evening when the two were appearing together to discuss Pullman's trilogy, His Dark Materials.
He pointed out that although I dealt with organized religion in that novel, His Dark Materials, I hadn't actually mentioned Jesus. Now, where did he fit into my alternative world?
Pullman resolved at that moment that he would write a book about Jesus. Some years later, he got the chance. The result is The Good Man Jesus and The Scoundrel Christ. In Pullman's version of the story, Jesus has a twin brother named Christ.
I was intrigued, you see, by the difference between the two parts of the name Jesus Christ that we commonly use interchangeably. So I thought, well, maybe there is a difference. Maybe there are two beings here, not one.
Christ, his mother's favorite, is weaker than Jesus, both physically and emotionally. Jesus takes up his father's trade, but early on asserts his independence from his family. He becomes an itinerant preacher, attracting big crowds with his charismatic personality. Christ follows his brother around, watching from the sidelines and writing down what he does. He begins embellishing the truth, at times reporting miracles when there were none. Pullman says his Jesus tracks closely to the Jesus described in the New Testament, whereas Christ is his own invention.
Christ is this complicated character, and I call him a scoundrel in the title, but as we soon come to see, he's not so much of a scoundrel as a confused man. Christ is like a figure in a novel. He's the only figure in the story who is like a figure in a novel because he's the only one who's made up.
But there is another fictional character who lurks on the pages of this story. He's known only as the Stranger, and he appears to Christ from time to time, encouraging him to continue writing down his version of what Jesus does and says, giving the impression that Jesus is more than just an ordinary man. It is important, the Stranger tells Christ, to interpret what Jesus means for his future followers. For a long time, Christ thinks the Stranger is an angel, but Pullman keeps his identity a mystery.
I wanted the reader to wonder about it, and I hope people will talk about it and wonder who this could be. If I had to name the Stranger, which I try not to do throughout the book, and whenever Christ seeks to know his name, the Stranger asks him a question or evades it in some way. But if I was pinned to the spot and forced to say what he was, I would say he was the spirit of the church, really.
Eventually, Christ not only betrays Jesus, he also stages his resurrection. As Christ begins to realize that what he's doing will lead to the creation of a church based on untruths, the Stranger argues that the deception is worth it.
Think of a sick man racked with pain and fear. Think of a dying woman terrified by the coming darkness. There will be hands reaching out to comfort them and feed them and warm them. There will be voices of kindness and reassurance. There will be soft beds and sweet hymns and consolation and joy. All those kindly hands and sweet voices will do their work so willingly because they know that one man died and rose again, and that this truth is enough to cancel out all the evil in the world. Even if it never happened, said Christ. The angel said nothing.
The Jesus who emerges from this story is a real person, a man Pullman admires, a man of strength and conviction with a gift for storytelling. But this Jesus is no God. If anything, he is all too human.
He's abrupt, he's scornful of his brother's arguments, and yet he's genuinely capable of tenderness and care. And the only passage where he speaks at length towards the end of the book in the Garden of Gethsemane, he really gives voice to what I feel and think about these big questions.
As Pullman imagines Jesus in the hours before his crucifixion, there is no reprieve from despair. There's only anger at a God who does not hear his prayers.
You're making a liar out of me. You realize that? I don't want to tell lies. I try to tell the truth. But I tell them you're a loving father watching over them all, and you're not. You're blind as well as deaf, as far as I can tell. You can't see, or you just don't want to look. Which is it? No answer. Not interested.
Pullman knows that his interpretation of the life of Jesus could draw the ire of some Christians. At one early public appearance, extra security was added in case of protests. But Pullman says he doesn't really expect to encounter angry mobs, And he says he doesn't care if people don't like the book, as long as they really read it and remember one thing.
This is a story among other stories. It doesn't make any claims to be the truth about anything. So it's a story.
Pullman says he hopes his book will send readers back to the Bible because he believes they might be surprised by some of the inconsistencies they find there. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Male porn stars have been known to don all sorts of interesting attire, but one thing you'll seldom see them wearing is a condom. For years, a group called the AIDS Healthcare Foundation has been lobbying to make condom use mandatory, and it's been a difficult fight. But as Alex Cohen of member station KPCC reports, change may be on the way.
LA's San Fernando Valley is known as the epicenter of porn. It's here where you'll find Vivid Video, the studio produced All-Star Big Butts, Debbie Does Dallas Again, and the Better Bosom Bureau. But Vivid also made this lesser-known video in which a young woman, fully clothed, looks into the camera and says,
"Workers in the adult film industry face particular hazards because actors perform sex acts in the course of making the films or videos."
No, it's not the sexiest video ever, but it is required viewing for all Vivid employees. The video goes on to explain the studio's rules. Performers must be tested for HIV and other diseases every 30 days. Sex toys will be disposed of after one use, and condoms will be made available to all performers.
And if girls choose to have condoms used in their scenes, then obviously we accommodate them. And some girls choose to, and most girls don't.
Steve Hirsch, Vivid Video's CEO, says many performers, both male and female, find it physically uncomfortable to do their jobs using condoms. And he adds most performers seem content with the current protocol for STD testing through a local clinic.
They put the results online. We can log in with a password. We can see whose tests are current, whose tests aren't current, and off we go.
We know that testing, while it is important, is not a substitute for condom use.
Michael Weinstein is the president of the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, which has been lobbying for years to make condom use mandatory. He points out that performers can have sex in between the time they get tested and when they're shooting a film. That can raise the risk for spread of disease. Weinstein says since 2004, nearly two dozen adult film performers in Southern California have tested positive for HIV.
HIV is not the only lifelong infection. You have herpes among many of the performers, women who are getting chlamydia, which is making them infertile, or other diseases which may make them susceptible to cervical cancer, etc.
Most porn producers agree these health risks are serious, but they don't think condoms are the solution. Steve Hirsch of Vivid Video says his company tried it before for nearly 7 years.
When we became a mandatory condom company, we saw sales drop by about 20%.
Hirsch fears a condom mandate would wipe out the region's multi-billion dollar adult film industry. He says in a state where unemployment tops 12%, California can't afford to lose more jobs.
People will shoot in Europe, people will shoot in Mexico, people will go other places to shoot, and you'll see an industry move out of this state.
The AIDS Healthcare Foundation counters that most gay adult films use condoms, and that sector of the industry seems to fare just fine. The group's president, Michael Weinstein, says he'd even be willing to make some accommodations for straight porn.
Based on the data we have, the risk for oral sex is far lower than it is for anal or vaginal sex. And for that reason, I think that regulations would make condom use for oral sex optional. I think it's a fair compromise.
Weinstein says it's obvious that Americans are watching porn, but few people want to talk about the issue. So far, the AIDS Healthcare Foundation has been unable to find a lawmaker willing to support legislation requiring condoms. They've sued the LA County Health Department, but the judge dismissed the suit. But then, last winter, the AIDS Healthcare Foundation filed a petition with the California Division of Occupational Safety and Health, or Cal-OSHA. The organization's board recently took the first step in requiring condoms. Use, they voted in favor of setting up an advisory committee to study the issue. Deborah Gold is a senior safety engineer with Cal-OSHA.
It's our job to make sure that a person goes to work in the morning or whatever time they go to work and leaves work whenever they leave work, and their health and their safety has not been jeopardized. And that applies to lead poisoning every bit as much as it applies to HIV transmission.
Gold says a condom mandate would support Kalosha's mission of safety, but she adds it could be hard to enforce. For example, porn shoots can be hard to track down since many happen in private locations instead of at established movie studios. These challenges are sure to come up when Kalosha's advisory committee meets for the first time in June. For NPR News, I'm Alex Cohen in Los Angeles.
The Gulf spill has cast a shadow over the prospects of more offshore drilling for oil and gas. Opening new areas for drilling has long been on Republicans' wish lists. And then this year, President Obama agreed to allow exploration in areas that had been off limits. And in the Senate, authors of a new bill that aims to slow global warming are pushing offshore drilling to win votes from reluctant senators. But as NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, the pro-drilling coalition is now starting to erode.
Days into the oil spill, President Obama said he still supports offshore drilling so long as it's done responsibly and doesn't damage the environment. For California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Gulf spill fails on both counts. Schwarzenegger announced that he's yanking approval of an offshore drilling project along his coastline because he no longer believes the assurances of the oil industry.
Despite those studies and support, all of you have seen when you turn on the television the devastation in the Gulf. And I'm sure that they also were assured that it is safe to drill. That would not happen here in California.
It was in California in 1969 that the mother of all U.S. rig spills occurred, just off the coast of Santa Barbara. Images of oil-soaked birds and beaches helped launch Earth Day and the modern environmental movement. Another hot spot in the offshore drilling debate is Florida. The state legislature is weighing a measure to open up new areas for offshore drilling. Susan Glickman, a consultant for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, says some Floridians had come around to the idea because of the country's dependence on foreign oil, but the spill appears to have trumped that concern.
There has been a definite switch in positions for some and a hardening of positions for others, you know, against drilling, which for a brief period of time was enjoying some increase in the public support and political support, but that is evaporating rather quickly.
Among the converts who switched from pro to con is Florida Governor Charlie Crist, who flew over the oil spill and decided Florida wasn't ready for new drilling. In Washington, D.C., expanded offshore drilling has won backing from quite a few stalwart environmentalists in the Senate who are pushing a new energy and climate bill up a very steep hill. The bill offers support for more offshore drilling and new nuclear power plants as a sweetener to win votes from skeptics who say the bill will raise consumers' energy costs. Former Colorado Senator Tim Wirth, who now heads the United Nations Foundation, says he expects the oil spill will upset the political apple cart in the Senate.
I think that there will be a number of coastal people who were previously supporting the bill who will want provisions related to aggressive drilling taken out of the bill.
Wirth says other senators who were on the fence are now likely to jump off onto the no new drilling side. The spill doesn't mean an end to offshore drilling. Large parts of the Gulf of Mexico are and will continue to be exploited. The Interior Department has leased many sites still waiting to be explored. But Wirth points out that these sites have to be carefully evaluated. British Petroleum site, for example, was unusually deep and technically difficult. He says the drilling industry had assured skeptics that new technology made it doable and safe.
I think the time has come to carefully examine the technologies that are now far out in front of our ability to manage those technologies.
The spill has galvanized those who fought against new offshore drilling, but Phil Sharp, a former U.S. congressman and head of the economics think tank Resources for the Future, says all Americans, politicians and consumers alike, should consider where the demand for new oil comes from.
It's a little bit disingenuous on our parts if we ethically think, oh my goodness, we're going to protect the environment, we're not going to allow drilling, but we're just going to consume to our heart's content.
Especially, he says, if drilling for oil beyond American shores is less regulated and even more hazardous to the environment than it is here. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
And our last word in business today comes from scientists in Kazakhstan. It's, where's the pork? The team has developed a device that instantly detects the presence of pork in food. Kazakhstan is largely Muslim, and Muslims are not supposed to eat pork, but a local newspaper reports that some chefs have been slipping pork into their beef dishes because it's cheaper. This new device can detect molecules that are only found in pork. Just put a bit of the questionable food in a glass of water, stir it around, insert the device, which is a little like a plastic stick, and in a minute or two, you'll know whether you can enjoy your dish of beef or whether you need to send it back. And that's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. You can follow our program on Twitter at Morning Edition.
I'm at NPR Inskeep, and if you have that special device, you can stir it around and find us on Facebook. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montagne.
Now we'll go from the Tennessee floods to the Saudi Arabian desert. Saudi King Abdullah gave $10 billion to an effort to solve some of the world's biggest problems. The result was a school called KAUST. That's an acronym for the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology. And it's meant to be more than just a university. NPR's Larry Abramson had a look inside.
KAUST rises from the desert north of Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, like the secret research lab in a James Bond movie. The desert blooms here thanks to a private desalination plant and an army of gardeners. With a private Red Sea beach, knock-your-socks-off architecture, and world-class labs, KAUST hopes to lure the world's brainiest scientists to this Xanadu for nerds. KAUST president Chun Fong Shi says this isn't a university in the traditional sense.
KAUST is a global university of the 21st century. It's a place where we integrate graduate education with research at the cutting edge.
That word, global, is thrown around a lot in higher education these days. Every university is trying to spread its wings and go international. What's different at KAUST? Well, for one thing, money. Money can buy some very nice science toys.
So this one here is a slice of a rat's brain stained in red, green, and blue fluorescing dyes. And right now you're looking at
Steve Cutchins manages the visualization lab at KAUST. He's standing in front of a room-sized video screen that shows a microscopic view of a rat's brain with stunning clarity. Cutchins says this display also enables smooth video conferencing to anywhere in the world, including with his former home campus at the University of California, San Diego, halfway around the globe.
The really driving idea behind this and all of this is the ability to do this collaboration and hold meetings and feel like you're talking to Washington, D.C., talking to Japan, and they're effectively just in the room or down the building.
There's something else KAUST's huge budget can buy, according to David Keyes, dean of math and computer sciences here.
You can purchase good friends, and we've purchased, if you will, a lot of very good friends.
Keyes left a nice post at Lawrence Livermore National Lab in California. KAUST is buying allegiances, Keyes says, by handing out big grants. Stanford, for example, is getting $5 million a year to help select KAUST faculty. Other schools receive millions to do joint research. At the same time, KAUST is trying to blow up the internal structures that often lead to internecine battles at traditional universities. For example, there are no departments here. Instead, David Keyes says KAUST pursues a mission-oriented strategy.
A mission-oriented program might be solar energy, as opposed to chemistry, physics, math, computer science, other things that are the disciplines that feed into that group.
And in a move that may shock the ears of any listening faculty, KAUST has done away with tenure. That's right, people here will be judged only by how many useful ideas or products they come up with. The first class of students here numbers about 400 from all over the world. They chow down in the light-filled cafeteria, one of the few places in Saudi Arabia where college-age men and women rub elbows. Computer science student Luca Passone is Italian and studied in England. He says he came prepared to do without, but instead was overwhelmed by the amenities.
We have a cinema, we have a beach, sports centers, multiple gyms. We are very, very lucky to have so many things available for us.
KAUST has to pile on the luxuries because life can be pretty austere outside the campus gates, and even on the property, students cannot get alcohol or pork, which are banned in this Islamic state. The university's relationship to the kingdom and to Islam are complicated at best. KAUST PR man, Christopher Sands, shows me around the KAUST Museum, which harkens back to the Arab world's golden age of learning a millennium ago.
Because the king's vision has always been to try to go back to what was the original House of Wisdom, intellectual inquiry and groundbreaking science and technology are deeply integrated with the values of Islam.
In fact, the king defied conservatives in his country by going ahead with KAUST as a co-ed school in a country where the sexes are still very segregated. Christopher Sands says religion is not taken into account in admissions, but in many ways KAUST remains faithful to Islam. Sands says there are 5 separate mosques on campus which can accommodate thousands, but there is no place here on or off campus for other faiths to worship.
People are free to worship. There aren't any official facilities for it, but people do worship in the way they wish.
KAUST may be an anomaly in the academic world. It is less of an oddity in Saudi Arabia, which has long had special compounds for foreigners working here. KAUST clearly has the resources to succeed in the world of global research. The question is whether it will have an impact just beyond its walls on the host country. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
As we know, health insurance premiums have been going up much faster than wages in recent years. Residents here in California with individual policies from Anthem Blue Cross were facing rate hikes of up to nearly 40%. The insurer put off its plans after being slammed by bad publicity and finding itself in a fight with the state's insurance commissioner. At least 2 other states have been in court trying to stop rate hikes. These episodes raise a big question about whether the new health law will hold down insurance premiums. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
The new federal health law leaves it up to each state to review and approve health insurance premium increases, basically the way it is now. And that worries Larry Kirsch. He's a health economist and consultant who works with states. He says when it comes to standing up to insurers, a lot of states are outmanned and outgunned.
The large majority of states would face a real challenge. They're stretched very thin.
Some states don't have their own experts to review rates, and they face enormous political pressure from insurers, which have lobbyists in every state. And even if the states could effectively insist that insurers drop their rates, he's not sure how much good it would do.
Even with this machinery, under the best of all possible imaginings, the likelihood of costs going up is probably very, very high.
It's not that insurers are always trying to make more money. Sometimes they're just passing on higher rates from doctors and hospitals. Massachusetts is an example of what happens when states try to hold down rates. A couple of years ago, the state required everyone to have health insurance. That's put a big focus on holding down insurance costs, says Nancy Turnbull. She has experience from working on the state's insurance review board. Now she's at Harvard and also helps oversee the new state plan. Last month, the state rejected virtually all proposed rate increases. Now the insurers are fighting back in court.
Certainly at the moment, rates have been rolled back to the level of last year. But if the court finds that the Division of Insurance exceeded its authority or didn't apply it correctly, then I think the consequence for consumers is going to be they're going to get large retroactive rate increases. And that's obviously not a good thing.
California Senator Dianne Feinstein says there's a role for the federal government here. She wants the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services to be able to block increases that are more about profit than about health care. Feinstein testified about that recently at a hearing.
This legislation simply creates a federal fallback, allowing the secretary to conduct reviews of potentially unreasonable rates in states where the insurance commissioner does not already have the authority or capability to do so.
But insurers don't like the idea of federal oversight. Karen Ignani heads the industry trade group, America's Health Insurance Plans.
Rate review should be done at the ground level, closer to the consumer.
And she says there are enough constraints on insurers under the new law as it is, such as caps on profits and administrative costs.
An arbitrary cap on rates would be similar to setting an arbitrary cap on the price of cars, but yet not controlling in any way or doing anything about the supply costs, the cost of steel, the cost of other types of elements that are embedded in making a car.
The challenge for whoever winds up with the task of overseeing insurance premiums will be how to cut excess profits while leaving the insurers enough money to pay doctors, hospitals, and drug companies. Joanne Solberner, NPR News.